Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's the Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Kelly Blaho. She's a regular at the American Conservative Magazine. That's American Conservative Magazine, or was it? No, it's theamericanconservative.com. And also antiwar.com, of course. She's got a brand new one on antiwar.com today. Welcome back to the show, Kelly. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing good. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's see. Where's the domestic jihad is the one that's on antiwar.com today, but the one that I wanted to talk with you about is from the American Conservative Magazine. It's called Eating Soup with a Spoon. Who ever heard of such a ridiculous thing? Learning to Eat Soup with a Spoon. Tell us, first of all, what's the title about there?
Well, the title is about, it's a riff off of a book written by Lieutenant Colonel John Nagle, who's retired from the Army now, but he wrote this book in 2002, basically comparing the counterinsurgency strategies by the British in Malaya to the Vietnam experience, our counterinsurgency attempts in Vietnam. And he had written this book. It was published in 2002, impeccably timed, so that it to suggest that a new strategy was necessary for Iraq, which was the book had come out in 2002 as a dissertation. So let me just pedal back for a second. He had done this for his Oxford dissertation, had served in Iraq, had come back, and was working on the counterinsurgency manual with David Petraeus when the dissertation was released as a book. So this all sort of coalesced around the new movement that I know you and I have talked to about many times, the new counterinsurgency movement, which was supposed to be the magic formula for getting us out of the morass that Iraq had become. Mm-hmm. Peaking, the failure peaking at in about 2005. So fast forward to a failed strategy of COIN, counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. And I write about how all of these crusaders, as Andrew Bacevich had called them in a great article for The Atlantic several years ago, these crusaders who had been so popular and had been at the forefront of changing our strategy in Afghanistan based on their supposed victory in Iraq are now fading from the scene. And I say that, Lieutenant Colonel Nagle is the best example of this fade out, in that he is now leaving his perch at a quite reputable Democratic interventionist think tank in Washington to go be the headmaster at a rich boys school in Pennsylvania. So I was using him as sort of the symbol of how this strategy has failed. You know, it failed in Afghanistan, and it has basically stunted the thinking for the last 3 years or so in the military community from really adapting to what's been going on the ground and moving things forward. Mm-hmm. So that was the long story about the title.
No, that's all right.
In his book, and I don't know if I got to this, his book was called How to Learn to Eat Soup with a Knife. Basically, he was saying how to adapt to insurgencies effectively. And so this book was very wildly popular in counterinsurgency circles for years as sort of a playbook. And he really benefited it personally and professionally from it. The title thus on my story is How to Eat Soup with a Spoon, basically saying, you know, when all is said and done, we realize that it's really better to eat soup with a spoon.
Right.
So knock it off.
Yeah, you might cut your lip.
Well, so that's where that came from.
Now, here's my thing. And we've talked about this before on the show too, Kelly. And that is that I think that the surge is a great success because I think it never was anything but a bunch of propaganda. And that its purpose was, as David Petraeus said in the case of Iraq back in 2007, this is all about adding time to the Washington clock, convincing, well, the only people that really need convincing are the congressmen, that give us a couple of more years and we'll make it work rather than stop paying for it now. And So can we prolong the thing and lose slower later? Yes. Hooray. Success. And that was basically all it ever was. And so did the surge work in Iraq? Yeah, because it was supposed to work on Americans. I mean, it didn't change the fact that the war was fought for Iran in the first place because the guys that got us into it are a bunch of stupid idiots. They couldn't undo that. You know what I mean? So,
right.
So they bribed the Sunni insurgents for a little while, whatever. And then the whole meme that the surge worked and that the counterinsurgency doctrine was really, really smart and achieved all its benchmarks and whatever, that was nothing but a bunch of hype. It was never anything but words. And so, really, my question is, did John Nagel and the rest of these Center for a New American Security types actually believe this? Did they not see that this was all just propaganda for the rubes that even in 2007, Lieutenant Colonel Kozlarich in East Baghdad, the book was covered in dust. No one was reading the counterinsurgency book. Their mission was go out there and kill people, and so they did it the same way they always did. You know, it was the doctrine was junk.
Yeah, Scott, I think you're asking a really important and maybe even an existential question here, because I can't get into the real heart and soul of John Nagel, nor do I want to. I think you have a real combustible combination here of ego, professional ambition, the desire to come up with a solution, like an honest desire to come up with a solution, politics, and probably just cynicism, all combined. And I can't pretend that I can single out what was motivating each player, whether it be Petraeus, McChrystal, Nagel, David Kilcullen, all these other coindonistas. I don't know. Everybody had their own personal motivation. What I'm seeing here is what you're saying is correct. The surge was to buy time. Somewhere along the line, in the bubble, in the echo chamber of the Washington military community, people like Nagel and the rest of the coindonistas bought into that as a credible, verifiable strategy for which to apply to Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever was motivating them to push it, they did.
Yeah, and I'm sorry about that. I didn't mean to phrase the question in such an unfair way.
You can take it at face value
that they mean what they say. It just seemed to me that since Gareth and I were sitting here before they even got started on the coin in Afghanistan, calling it nothing but a propaganda campaign in the first place, how could it have ever been more than that? But apparently it was.
Right, but I think that you're getting to the nub of the issue, and what maybe is the root of all of Washington's problems is that the players begin to buy into the hype, into the propaganda. And it may be for honest reasons, it could be for venal reasons, but it happened. But what happened was it all occurred in this bubble. What also occurred is there was no room and no oxygen for any alternative strategy or narrative or ideas. So people like Andrew Bacevich, all the people that write for antiwar.com, people that were writing in academic circles who were saying this strategy isn't going to work. Here is the history as to why it's not going to work. This is nothing but another way, a nice way of putting it, a smiley face on a foreign occupation. It's not going to work. Mm-hmm. Those people were all marginalized. All that was marginalized. Gian Gentile, a guy that I wrote about for the last, 4 years as being one of the active duty people who are trying to ram against COIN for all these years. Again, marginalized. So, whatever were the motivations and who was coming at for what direction, the outcome was that for 4 years, COIN has been the only show in town. So we've wasted all this time pumping up a strategy that turns out was a bunch of hoo-ha. So, yeah, we can probably laugh and snicker at the fact that Nagel now has to be the headmaster at a boys' school. And that a lot of these coindonistas hit, like what I said, was a brass ceiling and of going no further in their careers because the strategy did not work. But we've lost a lot of guys since then.
Right.
There's a lot of maimed people out there that maybe could have, might have been home. before
well, that's
they
one
lit.
Small thing is the proximate accountability of Michelle Flournoy having to retire instead of get promoted, and John
right.
Nagel going to be the headmaster instead of the Flournoy's replacement and the policy shop or whatever like that. That's the closest thing we could ever get to accountability in D.C.
Right.
It seems like.
Right, and I've been following with great interest all the comments that have come in on my story, and I have to say I'm rather pleased that they run half and half. Because I thought it was going to be a lot worse. I thought I was going to get a lot of military guys coming down on me like a ton of bricks. Oh, who is she? She doesn't know what she's talking about. She's never been in the military. But I've had a lot of people from military backgrounds weighing in saying, where's the accountability? Is this all we're going to get?
Right.
You know, and not just military people, but, you know, just from the public saying, is this all we're going to get? Will these people ever be held accountable? I think you and I, Scott, know Washington at this point enough to know that. And like I say, accountability is not on the menu. And
right.
we can only keep, you know, talking about it and writing about, you know, it in hopes that we don't make the same mistakes. But I do feel heartened that so many people from the military have weighed in on this, and that I know it's getting a lot of traction on military websites and on military mailing lists, which is kind of different for my stories, especially at, you know, whether it be antiwar.com or American Conservative, because people think because me and others are, you know, anti-militarism, you know, anti-war, that somehow we don't have a, you know, can't really engage on that level. But I'm really hitting a real nerve with people. You know, enough for them to come out and comment, and enough for them to say, to pass it along and say, you know, we've been talking about this in military circles. You know, this is a real issue. So that's the one heartening thing. And I know that I've talked about this before, but I think when inside the military, when they're complaining and they know something's wrong and they know this coin was a bill of goods sold to them, that means something, because that means that internal dissension. Somehow, you know, that things might change, you know. And you and I would rather not see any war. Probably want to see the military reduced to, like, you know, pre-World War II levels. But any change, I think, at this point is good.
Yeah. Well,
any dissension is good.
To me, it's such an interesting case study in, you know, consensus and groupthink and all that, like you're talking about, where it's the only show in town in D.C. What's the future of Afghanistan? There's really one organized group with a coherent narrative to sell. Whether it's all that coherent or actually a plausible way to occupy Afghanistan is sort of besides the point. They're the
yeah.
jocks and the cheerleaders that everybody
yep.
wants to be like or be seen having a drink with or whatever
yep.
kind of crap. And so they rule the town. And then, so what's their policy? We're talking about coin this and coin that. Their policy is make the Afghans love us as we burn them to death. Yeah.
Right.
That's, and you know what, if you just turn the Phillips head and tune it just right, then it'll work out perfect. And they'll love being burnt to death by us because we're the Americans and we love them and whatever. But meanwhile, if you have a counterinsurgency doctrine, that implies you're an empire in the first place.
Right.
You know, according to our mythology, we're the insurgents. Why, how could anyone insurge against us unless we are dominating them in the first place? You know,
yeah.
What in the hell are we doing there? Copying the French in Algeria, copying any empire in any of their colonies, other than acting like we're not supposed to act, like we all know we're not supposed to do, you know, build an empire like the British in Central Asia of all places.
Right, exactly. And if we really wanted to do it right, and we really want to, you know, the sad fact of it is that we'd have to really start rounding up people and killing them. Full scale. And we've talked about this years ago, Scott, on the radio. You know, we were trying to have it both ways. We were trying to pacify the Pashtuns, but at the same time, you know, blow kisses and hand candy off. And it's not work. You cannot have it both ways. You have an effective counterinsurgency, you know, strategy, which involves like putting people in concentration camps, separating them from, you know, separating the people from the insurgency, just rounding up all, boys over the age of 12 and just slaughtering them. Or you can't have a successful counterinsurgency, just get out of there. And we wanted to have it both ways, and now we're seeing the fruits of that now in Afghanistan, where we're in a serious quagmire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we won't even be able to get out inexpensively and unscathed. I mean, the stories that were coming up last week, about how we're going to have to put more troops in just to get everything out of there.
They've suspended all the training, and that's supposedly their exit plan, right? We're going to train up an army, they'll stand up, we'll stand down and all that. And yet now they're afraid to train their sock puppets because their sock puppets keep shooting our guys in the head.
Right, and some people had the nerve to comment on my story saying, you don't know what you're talking about, things are going great. Why don't you and you journalists who've never served in the military come to Afghanistan and see how great things are going? I mean, they still have mouthpieces in the military that are still hawking this stuff. And it's just embarrassing, because the minute they say that, I get some Twitter blast about just what you said, how everything's been suspended in training because we can't trust the Afghans and we haven't been vetting them properly. And so, or I read this great story I recommend by Spencer Ackerman from Wired, who is saying that of all the top 10 violent districts in Afghanistan, the majority of them are in Helmand and Kandahar, which was the focus of this 2009 surge.
Right.
So the very place that we surged into is the place that's giving us the biggest headache right now.
Right. Well, and it was Noggle that said, what we're going to do here is we're going to change entire societies.
Right. We've got to change entire societies. It's like, like Andrew Bacevich says, it's not just counterinsurgency, it's social engineering. We're supposed to change societies, the way people think.
Well, and the only thing you could really do to a society is make sure that it hates yours. That's the only change you could really make in somebody else's entire country's way of life. I mean, come on.
Right. And another thing,
More AIDS now from all the Western brothels in their capital city.
Well, another thing that I've been getting flack for is that I'm blaming mid-level officers for everything that's gone wrong. Now, I want to say this right here and right now. If you're John Noggle and you're going out and you're on The Daily Show in your uniform with your shiny medal, pumping up coin like it's the magic formula for saving Iraq and Afghanistan, and then you're in every major magazine, you have a 9,000 word piece in the New York Times magazine about yourself, and now you are the reincarnated T. Lawrence of Arabia. Somehow that it kind of sets you apart. You're not just a mid-level officer. You're a guy who is actually selling the strategy to the public, to the rest of the media, to the media and to Washington. Yeah, you do hold some responsibility. And I fixate on him because he did act in that capacity. And I'm sorry. And people said, oh, this was a vicious slam. I don't think so. I wasn't ad hominem either. I told the facts. The guy was out there selling this strategy. It's failed. The fact that he is leaving, Washington out of the military community altogether, that does say something about the state of affairs. And I don't take away the responsibility for Petraeus or McChrystal. But see, Noggle was in essence a creature of Petraeus. You remember Petraeus having all of his little acolytes around,
right,
his little advisors helping him write the counterinsurgency manual.
Right, Noggle's really nothing but another Tom Ricks, just another PR guy. Another
right,
warm body in the room
guy,
making
yeah.
it look like there's a consensus of dunces here who know that this is right.
Right. So, yeah, there's an...
It's really no difference than an AEI
around.
Conference in 2002. All smart right. people know we have to do Iraq, except maybe you, but you're a coward. But everyone
right.
who knows anything knows this must be done.
Exactly. And everybody else with a dissenting view was pushed away as some sort of loony, kook, dissenter, defeatist, I mean, you name it. And then it turns out people like Ron Paul don't sound so crazy after all this, but because they, you know, now their interest is in protecting their own reputations, they still will not admit that he was right.
Right.
And that the people like Gian Gentile and Andrew Bacevich were right. So they'll go down in flames into every boys' school, you know, headmastering everywhere before they'll admit it. But we know.
Right.
And that's what, you know, writing these stories is all about. I mean, we have to, I mean, how are we going to learn from our mistakes if we don't, you know, just hammer away at the fact that you were wrong? And, you know, you're going to, this is, we have to burst the bubble somewhere. But, you know, before you let me go, I wanted to mention, I came across, you know, another Coindonista, Andrew Exum, announced on his blog, you know, this weekend that he's not going to be blogging anymore for a year because he got a fellowship with the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's going to be working in the government for the next year. And I was like, well, what's that all about? So I Googled up, you know, the link that he provided to CFR, and it turns out they have these international fellowships where they take people from policy think tanks and put them into government. So basically, they're selected policy, you know, think tanks and organizations that, you know, obviously jive with their own agenda, they will find you a little place in government to promote and for, you know, forward that agenda.
Hey, that's what the Council on Foreign Relations has been about since 1921.
I know, but I
we'll find you a job.
Yeah,
you just gotta push our doctrines.
Facilitate, you know, basically the HR for the government. And right. I guess I kind of knew that stuff was going on, but I just hadn't really looked into it before. But, you know, and then they take people in government and they put them, and they have them working outside of government in some policy shop somewhere, and they do this sort of switching around.
You know what it is to me? It's like the way they homogenize milk. They take it and they just shake the hell out of it until it's all the exact same consistency all the way through.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what you do. You take all your different, you know, Ivy League grads, and you put them in all the different positions where they have a pretty much equally divided loyalty to all of them. So you never have, like, a partisanship that these people favor a think tank than actual government work or something like that. That's never a split. It's always, you know, rapidly moving around, and you'll get a board of directors spot at Lockheed for a little while too, if you play the cards right, cash in.
It's amazing, and I think that I'm just astounded by the fact that it is so bald, you know, that you could take somebody from a think tank that has a particular foreign policy view, which is, you know, is what they call, you know, humane, or, you know, what do you call, liberal interventionism, you know, all that smarmy, you know, language and semantics, and put them into a government job. And you can stay in that job for a year and then go back to your think tank. And I'm thinking, I don't know if that's, to me, that's not what government is all about. You know, government is not finding places for people. I mean, I realize it's a naive point of view, but after everything that's happened, you know, I realize down deep that nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
The people
well,
that are
you
getting
hate to see somebody like Exum fail up instead of down, like Nagel got what was coming to him.
I know.
You know.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. We're still not there yet on the on the accountability menu. That's for sure.
Although now, you know, to really put an exclamation point on your point as to why it is that Michelle Flournoy had to go spend time with her family, and why it is that John Nagel had to go be the principal of a bunch of little third graders. It is because of the failure of their pathetic failure of a doctrine, and the proof of that is that they're rewriting it right now, correct?
Yeah.
They have officially thrown John Nagel's pathetic, stupid, wrong ideas, which did in fact get a lot of people killed, in the garbage can where they belong because they don't work.
Yeah. And, you know, and he, of course, he's not responsible for the entire, you know, counterinsurgency manual because, in fact, it was written by a committee of people. I mean, everybody, you know, they had, you know, and he bragged about this. We have a Harvard sociologist, and we have an economics guy from Yale, and this one, and they all poured into it. I mean,
well, that's the cool thing about
responsibility
is the mathematics don't have to really add up correctly. They can all be 100% responsible, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, right, but I'm saying that it was doomed to fail to begin with. Now, yeah, now they're rewriting it, and of course, the people who, you know, the sympathetic types are saying, well, you know, we've had 5 years of war since that came out, and, you know, we've learned lessons, and we have to just imbue this with the lessons that we've learned, you know, whatever. You know, the fact it was a flawed, strategy, a flawed book, you know, and now they're trying to tweak it, you know, and the fact that people for the last few years have been talking about what a piece of crap it was.
Well, you know, and the thing is, too, is I know I'm rude, and I know I say, like, I make it personal and talk about, you know, the people Nagle helped get killed and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, and in fact, I had a good friend of mine criticize me for that and saying, you know, hey, maybe, you know, Samantha Power just really means well for the poor people of Libya, and so you shouldn't attack her for it. But you know what? If John Nagle and Samantha Power all have only the highest, most loving humanitarian reasons for deploying the American Empire, that's so much the worse. That makes them even worse people, because the Empire is a murderous machine. It is not a loving, caring thing. And so
yeah.
If, you know, all of their best intentions be damned, if they serve to simply be public relations for what is,
yeah,
in essence, a bunch of murderers on a rampage.
And the fact, too, that there's a difference between, you know, putting all of your energy into selling and defending a concept rather than debating it. And I make that point in my mm-hmm. column. There were alternative views there, and I am tired of hearing people, whether it be in the comment field for my story, saying, they were doing their best with the little they had. How could they possibly know this was going to happen or that was going to happen? That's bull. We know that there are people from the beginning who are giving alternative views. Who
hey,
are saying,
Joe
this
Biden
isn't
knew
work.
Better. Ha ha.
Yeah.
I
and
mean,
so, and they
on.
Shut all that out purposefully. So, yeah, they might have had the best intentions, but when it came, when people actually confronted them with another reality, they said, get out. You don't belong. You're not of the body. You know, you're not one of us. Like you said, boys club, girls club, cheerleaders and football players, whatever.
Right.
They push those people aside. So whatever best intentions they might have had, they lost any sympathy for me, because I know how those other people were treated, the naysayers were treated, and quite brutally. And I mean, I know plenty of people who's professional careers were thwarted and sidelined or stunted because they didn't toe the line.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it's been in Washington since the entirety of the war.
Yeah, they have no mercy for their detractors, but you're supposed to have ultimate mercy for them, even though,
right,
you know, nobody's perfect. But Kelly, I've never heard you make a bunch of arguments that got a bunch of innocent people killed, you know, and that's the same thing for me, too. I screw up a lot, but I don't sit around promoting, you know, excuses
for prolonging
mass violent conflicts.
And for putting more troops into harm's way.
Right.
Because that's what this surge in Afghanistan was all about. I mean, I remember Nagle saying, well, you'd need 100,000 more troops or more than that if you really wanted to do COIN right. So, I mean, if these guys had their way, there would have been double the number. And I remember,
and the result would have been twice as bad.
Yeah, and you remember the debate. McChrystal wanted this many, and Obama only gave him this many, and all the right-wingers were up in arms. Why aren't they listening to his generals on the ground? And, you know, they had their way. They put more cannon fodder out there.
Yep. And, you know, their test cases, specifically, and you mentioned Kandahar, there was also Marja. These were their specific test cases where they said, look, we are going to change their society. We are going to give them a government in a box. We are going to show them that our way of understanding, their way of doing things is the best way to do things, and they are going to go along, and it's going to work, and it's going to be great. And as of right now, that is all just proven factually to not be true. Kandahar is no more under the control of the American, will to power, or whatever you call it over there, than it ever was. And same for Marja. Now, last I looked at Marja, they don't even have roofs on their buildings. Marja looks like just mud walls to me, as best I can see on Google Earth there.
Well, this goes back to what we were talking about before, about how they bought into their own propaganda and hype. Because right about the time that this Marja government in the box was like, that was at the beginning of the Obama administration. And it was like during this period of this bad marriage between these, you know, warmongering Republican outgoing administration and the incoming touchy-feely humanitarian interventionists of Samantha Powers and others coming in. And basically what Petraeus is trying to do is sell this war, incorporating all of this, and basically selling it as, oh, this is coin. We're all of government. We're whole of government. We're going to offer schools. We're going to offer, you know, good governance. We're going to, you know, offer, you know, lessons in democracy and building up their judiciary. And, you know, in addition to securing these populations, we can do it. And, you know, that's the way it was sold. And the Democrats are like, yes, this is our war. This is the way we want. This is the way to fight war, is to do this whole of government thing. It's so touchy-feely. It's so wonderful. You know, and the Republicans couldn't complain because we were still bombing the hell out of them. And it was a big mess. And that's what you said. What do you have to show for it? Those districts are the most violent right now.
Yeah.
And Karzai is still in power. He's still corrupt. You know, the place is still a powder keg. Pakistan, God knows what's going on over there. And then our presidential candidates don't even want to talk about it when they get to their conventions.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? In fact, as long as we're over time, can you stay for another few minutes?
Sure.
Because I want to focus on that point about Hamid Karzai. Because here in 2009, right around the same time that Obama announced the surge, of course, they orchestrated this whole thing to try to get rid of Karzai. And they tried to rig the election for that guy, Abdullah Abdullah. And the CIA put it in the New York Times that Karzai can't be trusted because his brother is a CIA tied heroin dealer. And that was supposed to undermine him. Which, you know, it did to me. But anyway, and then, you know, Michael Hastings reported that he's a junkie. Yeah. And I think, right, it was, you said his name earlier, the ambassador's name started with a K, the former military guy.
Oh, Kilcullen, David
right.
Kilcullen? Yeah.
Wasn't it one of those guys wrote, a very high level guy wrote a thing about how, Karzai was a junkie, right?
Yeah, I gotta look that up because I can't remember who exactly put that out there first.
And I know McChrystal's guys, if not McChrystal himself, said that to Michael Hastings, that
right.
he's not even the mayor of Kabul, he's the mayor of his palace where he sits around
yep.
shooting junk
exactly.
all day. This guy, this is our sock puppet dictator of Afghanistan. He's supposed to ever be able to control that whole country or be the administrator of a government that controls that whole country? The whole thing, it's not just ridiculous, it's cruel that you would send Americans to go out there killing and dying for what could never possibly be. And I don't care if you had, you know, the actual perfect counterinsurgency strategy, you still could never really create a government out of Hamid Karzai and his
right.
men.
Right. Which begs the question, why? You know, and I'm sure there's a simple, you know, answer that's eluding me at this very moment. But it's a simple question. Why have we been propping him up? Why couldn't, and I think one explanation is that there is no alternative. The alternative
right, yeah.
is disaster.
Right, he's the closest thing they've got to somebody who even could be a sock puppet dictator there.
Yeah, exactly. There's no alternative.
And the thing is, you know, I understand that people get mad and say, well, you know, you just don't understand and what they're doing over there is the right thing and whatever. But I would just like to see all that same indignation turned around to the people who really deserve it. That, like, wait a minute. What do you mean that you're sending our guys over there to play the IED lottery for something that everyone understands and agrees cannot be won? In fact, this was going to be one of my questions earlier where you were shocked as me. I really was shocked. When I read in the Washington Post that excerpt from the book Little America, where it says that Obama refused to read a CIA report that he had already heard said in it that this won't work. And so he just refused to read the thing. Rather than read it and say, well, I disagree with it, he just, you know, put his fingers in his ears and started singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and ordered his surge anyway.
Yeah. Well, that sounds about right. I mean, that was the entire atmosphere of Washington at that time, too. I mean, so
good for the CIA that they even bothered to tell the truth on that.
Yeah. You know, we're never going to know, Scott. I mean, the fact that we've been talking about this, and I've been talking about this privately with people for years, people that are in government, in the military, in, you know, who have pretty readily admitted that this was a failure from the get-go. And the fact that never bubbled up into any real dissension, we'll never know. I don't
right.
think we'll ever know the depth of how we were manipulated,
Because, like you said, it's not a matter of controversy between the political parties in the election. And so it doesn't matter at all. It might as well be a debate about angels on the head of a pin, even though it's about a war that's going on right now during a presidential election. They're not even talking about it because there's nothing at issue.
Still there. Right. I don't know. It's a pretty scary scene. And I don't think it's, you know, in terms of, you know, moving forward, whether it be in Iran or Syria, I don't think that the people operating, you know, at the level of Congress or the White House, I just don't think that they have the wherewithal to lead us in any better direction right now. I mean, when I was watching Fox, I was watching Fox News the other night, and they had their little commentary about the convention. And here's Stephen Hayes from, you know, Weekly Standard, you know, and they had to admit that the Ron Paul people were making a real, you know, causing a lot of buzz in the hall that day, you know, and they admit that he had, you know, really influenced whether it be the platform, but also the mood and of the Republican Party politics at that moment. But he goes, I'll never agree with him on his foreign policy. He's just a kook. He's too much of an extremist. And I'm thinking, extremist? I would say if you polled most of the people in this country, they would agree at least a basic level with Ron Paul about our foreign policy and the wars.
Well, and especially coming from Hayes, who's been for everything that got a million people killed over the last decade. To call someone who's reluctant to commit such violence extreme is pretty hilarious.
Right. But the even sadder thing is that they turn to Mara Liasson, who's like the Democratic voice on the Fox News, you know, special report, what do they call them, all-stars or whatever, saying basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, all those Ron Paul people never get anywhere. They're just too far on the extreme, you know, especially on the foreign policy. And I'm like thinking, how can you say that after all the years? But if that is if that represents the mainstream thinking of politics in Washington from the left and the right, Stephen Hayes and Mara Liasson, then we're in trouble. Because there's just no room for me and you, and there's no room for most of Americans who are tired of the war. They're tired of the militarism, but that's not part of the platform.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this is the lesson that comes through in your writing more than anything else. You're sort of, you know, the real American's mole in the imperial capital. So, hey, everybody, I went to the big meet today and here's what they were telling each other. And it's always some, you know, face palming, just ridiculous, horrible thing that these people believe and convince each other and slap each other on the back and congratulate each other for figuring out too. And I mean, their consensus is just horrible. And I've actually learned as much about it from you as anyone else in my life, I think, reading your articles about,
here's what they talk about
at their conference. Here's what these people really believe.
Yeah. It's exactly. Sad. And I think what's important is to hold it, just squaring the circle here, is to hold these people who have dominated, you know, our thinking, or tried to dominate the thinking about war for the last 5 years or so. We need to hold them accountable. And when they fail or when they have to leave town with their tail between their legs, we need to point it out as to why and what's going on. Because I've been talking about this for years, about this coin bubble. You know, and the fact that, you know, it's all burst and everybody knows it now, that's not enough. We need to talk about it because, like you said, it's got many people killed. And it's not just our people. Look at what the people in Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, what's going on in Yemen now, another more civilians killed in a drone attack, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and that really, to me, the most important lesson is just regardless of what a ridiculous doctrine it is and what a failure of a doctrine is, what a success the propaganda has been. And you think about it, it's just like George Bush always did. He'd have the three word, usually three syllable slogan behind him on the wall when he was talking. And the surge worked. Well, first the Surge is working for about two-thirds of a year or so, and then the Surge worked ever since. That, it's such a powerful slogan, and it's so easy to memorize. And again, hey, Mara Liasson and Goofball from the National Review agree, and so apparently no reasonable person disagrees with that. The Surge worked, everybody knows it, so nobody even has to have an argument for it. The slogan wins, and so, like you're saying, you can just go right on into Yemen and Somalia based on a slogan and a fake history that, you know, has never really been taken apart. And so, hey, you know, if the Surge has worked so well, why don't we just go ahead and surge into Somalia and that'll finally get rid of al-Shabaab?
Right, exactly. And if the Surge works so well, why isn't John Nagle like Deputy Secretary of Defense, Undersecretary of Defense right now?
Right.
On his way up to maybe the highest level. I mean, that's what I was trying to get at. I mean, I would love to see, and I would love to write this book and go through and find out how many people whose careers had benefited, you know, from, you know, the coin enterprise.
Ooh, you should write that book.
Yeah, because we're not just talking about military careers, because, and you know, there's plenty of those people who rose up through the ranks and, because of, you know, of being within that inner circle of Petraeus or towing the line or promoting and write papers about coin, who've done the coin studies and taught coin studies. But how about the people who wrote the books, the civilian people, all the people who've sucked up to Petraeus and sucked up to the whole cabal of, you know, coindonistas over the years? I mean, we're talking a cottage in its industry here that was born out of war, born out of simple, what it was basically a compendium of tactical, you know, military tactics had become a strategy, which has become an enterprise. And it would be great to see how many people really benefited. I mean, it's like we always talk about, war is a business. This was a business. And I think, you know, I think people are starting to take the Surge in Iraq apart. And I think that by, you know, talking about coin and the failed enterprise there is just one more step on finally dismantling that myth of the Iraq War Surge, because it all goes back to that. You know, if it wasn't for what you said, the propaganda, the hype, buying the time and having it work, then there would have never been the coindonistas. So
yep,
it's all of a piece. And if we keep hammering at it, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
the least
well,
we can do.
And you know, you're our leader. You're the best of all and most consistent of all coin revisionism this whole time. And so may they all follow you and your journalism. That's what I say.
Well, I appreciate you're very kind, but I have to say, you know, for others, I would say Gian Gentile, you know, who I have to say was very generous and very brave and letting me interview him Q&A for anti-war, because, you know, most active duty people don't want to touch anti-war. Come with a 10-foot pole. And here he is saying, hey, sure, let's sit down for an interview. And it really worked out well, because it worked out for antiwar.com, because people were starting to take us, that at least on that issue, a little more serious, because, hey, we got this interview. We talked to this guy. He's active duty professor at West Point. You know, he's not your typical anti-war subject. But we were able to start making a foray into this story. You know, and he was like, hell, you know, he needed as many, supporters or at least allies in this fight as we did, you know, and he was out there. He's always responded to criticisms right outright. You know, they tried to take me apart on smallwarsjournal.com on this story, and he was the first one to weigh in, because I did interview him for the story, but he was the first one to weigh in. He said, you know what? I'm not posting on your website anymore. Because he basically had enough. Here was the guy at Small Wars Journal saying that, you know, Kelly Blahos is full of crap. You know, how dare she blame John Nagle, he's a real man for getting, he said this, a real man who went into the arena to do the job himself instead of standing back as an angry distractor. I mean, every trope you could throw at me, he did. And Gian Gentile said, okay, you're right. We should thank Nagel for getting us this war we can barely get out of now, and killing all these men and women, you know, or being responsible for all these deaths. You're right, and I'm never posting on your website again. And I was like, whoa.
Yeah. I mean, that is good that he defended you.
Yeah, but he was like, enough. Tired of the bull. You know, we've gone back and forth on this for 5 years. Gian has always been up there fighting with these guys on the military block.
Yep, and who's teaching third grade now?
Yeah. So, I mean, I mean that if anybody, he and people like, you know, Andrew Bacevich, I've mentioned, you know, these people have hung in there. Sadly, they've been marginalized, but, you know, that's how it goes with the great, you know, great thinkers and people and independent thinkers throughout history. They're often marginalized and die destitute, but they're often well remembered.
Right. We write tales about them later on. Boy who said the emperor wears no clothes.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Kelly. It's been great. Always love reading your work.
Well, thank you
great
so
to
much.
Talk to you
thanks
again.
For letting me spout off.
Yeah. No problem. Anytime. All right, everybody, that's the great Kelly Vallejo. She writes for Antiwar.com and the American Conservative magazine, theamericanconservative.com. That's where you can find this piece, Learning to Eat Soup with a Spoon. You might have thought it was obvious, but not in D.C.